Welcome to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, a show featuring the people, stories, and events of Central Iowa. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. Well, it's that time of year. The students have left Iowa State, and the local high school students are waiting for school to let out. But not all of them are strictly focused on school's end. A dozen students from Ames High School, along with at least the same number of middle school students, took off yesterday for Menominee, Wisconsin, to participate in the national competition of the Science Olympiad. This was a consequence of both Ames teams winning the state competition back in April. A number of them came to the studio along with their coaches a couple weeks ago and spoke with station manager Ursula Rudenberg. We have that interview in the second half of the show. The theme of the first half is water, with Ames Water Plant issuing letters to a few select residents about the possibility of lead contamination through their service lines. But this is nothing at all like Flint, Michigan, as you will hear from my interview with Water Plant Superintendent Lyle Hammes. But first, I visited with Alex Pfeiffer of the Ames Historical Society about the abandoned and filled-in car pool in what is now known as Carr Park on the east end of town. Only one structure, the old bathhouse, stands as a relic of the 80 years of summer fun Ames residents had at the pool, built by Reuben and Alpha Carr. This couple, affectionately known as Ma and Pa Carr, because they took in a number of foster children, built the pool on behalf of the children of Ames. Here's the story from our regular Local Talk guest, Alex Pfeiffer.
You know, if we go way back to the teens, Ames did not have a swimming pool at all. There was no city structure, anything like that. And so kids were swimming in the Skunk River, in a little place where Reuben Carr was actually removing sand. They were using the sand to actually pave Ames streets, to use as a sub base for that. So he was digging sand out of the Skunk River, and the kids eventually picked on that, hey, there's this big hole over here where we can dive in and swim. But around 1925, there were several near drownings, and so this prompted the community to think about building a swimming pool. And in February 1926, a petition was launched to do the swimming pool, to build one. But unfortunately, it failed.
And what do you know?
Yeah. For some of you that remember the aquatic center going in, that failed quite a few times, too, before it was passed. So it seems to be kind of the theme. So in February of 1926, when it failed, Reuben and his wife, Alpha Carr, they decided to, hey, let's build our own swimming pool. So in May of 1926, they announced they'd build a 60 by 175-foot swimming pool on their land, which is now Carr Park near the Skunk River.
Now, how do they have the money to do this? Who are the Carrs in the Ames community?
Reuben was, like I said, he had a sand and gravel business that they were operating out of the Skunk River. And he also built silos. So he would be traveling around, you know, staying in Algona or something for a week, building a silo, and he would come back. And we actually have a lot of really sweet postcards written to his young bride, Alpha, when he would be away, saying how much he missed her and stuff like that. So, and actually, when they built the pool, they didn't even actually have enough money to do it. But local businessmen that knew Reuben and trusted him, stood behind him, they basically fronted him the money to build this pool and didn't charge him until after the pool was in operation for a lot of the building materials. So wow. That's how they were able to make that happen, yeah.
Now, I know there was a Carr Hardware. Are they connected at all to the pool?
No, different Carr family. No relation there, as far as we know.
Okay. All right, back to the swimming pool.
Yeah, so in May they announced they were going to build it, and it officially opened on July 4th, 1926. Perfect timing, right, for a good 4th of July weekend. And that was only 27 days after Reuben announced that he was going to build the pool.
Wow.
It was built and done. Yeah, talk about getting things done.
And when I first came to town just 10 years ago, there was a carpool. Is it the same exact structure that he built? Or
they had gone through some renovations. I'm talking with Kathy Sveck here. It's believed that the original pool basin, I think, survived up until the 80s. They had done some things, like I believe when it was first built, it was only I think 8 feet deep or so. And then they, you know, dug down to about 11 feet in the deep areas. And I think the shallow end was like a foot and a half, and they dug it down to 2. So they were always constantly doing little repairs and things, little upgrades like that. The bathhouse that we're talking about is not the original bathhouse, in fact. The original bathhouse sat there up until the mid-80s when they did a huge renovation project up at Carpool. And at that point, when it had been renovated, it was the City of Ames had purchased it in March of 1972 for about $70,000 and then transferred the management of it to the Ames Park and Recreation Department. And then that's when they renamed the pool from Cars Pool to Carpool in honor of him. So that's you can kind of tell by what terminology people use which pool they went to. If they remember it back in the day before the city took over it, they'll call it Cars Pool.
Huh. Interesting. Yeah. Take off the possessive.
Yes.
So a bathhouse. I'm just trying to, picture how people would swim in swimming pools back in the 20s. Was this a different style of swimming than we have today?
Well, the original pool, the earliest photos we have, it actually looks more like an above-ground pool. So they kind of have, rather it being the top being level with the ground and having all this cement around it, they had basically just built a cement container to hold water.
Yeah.
And, and some of it was dug down. It was dug deep enough underwater, but it looks like about a foot to 2 feet of a cement lip basically around the edge. And then they had sand just around the outside of it.
Of course, that sand.
Yeah, and I imagine they tracked a lot of it into the pool. And it was actually, the pool was, they had a little moniker that it was as clean as drinking water. It was well water, so it was a nice, it was very cold, I hear, from people who swim there. Very cold water, but it was very, very clean. And it actually came up through a fountain they had in the middle of the pool. So a lot of people thought that was just – it seems very just aesthetic that it just was something there. But that was actually where all the water came in was through this fountain. So it's very
– amazing.
Yeah.
It's like one of those movies with the synchronized swimmers and things.
Yeah, exactly.
Their bathing caps.
But yeah.
So what happened to the pool? Did they just fill it in then?
Yes. It closed down in 2009 when the Furman Aquatic Center passed. And so they decided to close Carpool. And I was talking with Kathy Speck again. And we believe that we remember the pool was – there wasn't a pool in Ames for 1 year on that because they closed down Cars Pool at the end of 2009.
Oh, you're saying it, Cars Pool.
Oh, I am saying it wrong. Sorry. Carpool. I'll get myself straight. So the Furman Aquatic Center opened up in 2011. And then in 2012, they actually demoed the pool, took all the cement out, and then infilled it and planted grass on top. So now you get over there and you can't even tell there was a swimming pool there besides just the bathhouse that remains in the back.
Well, there was a little bit of a struggle over that, I believe, about the closing of Carpool.
Yeah, it's been around since, 1926. There's a lot of fond memories of that, generations and generations of kids that learned how to swim there. That was the only swimming structure in Ames for at least outside of the university for many years. So that was the place to go where everyone learned how to swim. And it was kind of a place where people were all on a level playing ground. There were no classes at the swimming pool. Everyone came and swam together. So after the pool was demoed in 2012, after that, that's when they had renamed the area to officially be Car Park instead of the Cars Pool areas. So we have Car Park, but there's also Car Woods that is in the riverside. Car Nutty McDonald Gunder Woods area, which is on the east side of the river, while Car Park is on the west. So they kind of have two little parks up there named after them.
Wow. Are there any Car descendants in this community?
I know that Gary Carr, who would be the grandson, he is still alive, but I don't believe he resides in Ames. The Historic Society had a little chat with him last year when he came to town for a class reunion. And I believe the sister Donna Carr is still around, which we owe a lot of our resources, our photos on Cars Pool to Donna and to Gary, because they came in with scrapbooks that had little, newspaper clippings about the opening of the pool and lots of great images of it. So we owe a lot to the Carr family for helping keep that story alive.
Oh, well, maybe we'll use one of those images for our webpage. That sounds like a lot of fun.
Yeah.
It must have been great for them growing up in this, owning their own pool.
Right. Yeah. Gary eventually went on to manage it for some years after Ruben had died. And so it's just a great story. And if you'd like to hear more about Carr's Pool on Tuesday, May 24th, we are having a lecture presented by Kathy Sveck at the Ames Public Library at 7 p.m., and that'll be about the story of Carr's Pool. So if you'd like to hear a little bit more, we'd love to have you there.
That sounds great. What a great way to start off the summer. Thank you very much, Alex Fafer, Ames Historical Society.
Thank you, Greta, for having me.
And you're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. Well, yesterday's Ames Tribune had front page headlines about lead in Ames drinking water. But to be perfectly clear, the headline was, "Lead not a problem in Ames water." Evidently, the disaster that befell Flint, Michigan this year had prompted numerous questions of the Ames Municipal Water Plant about the possibility of lead in our drinking water. Since the city is due for a round of water testing this year anyway, it took it upon itself to search their records for those who might have the slightest possibility of lead in their service lines. And that is what this headline is about. Here's Lyle Hammes, the superintendent of the Ames Water Plant. So, Lyle, we've read the news that 300 residents in Ames are receiving letters from the city about the potential for lead contamination in their water. Could you explain what's happening?
Yeah, the council meeting next Tuesday, after the council meeting the next day on Wednesday, we expect to send out letters to about 303, I think is the exact number of residents in the city of Ames that we have identified that have lead service lines or partial lead service lines. We've gone back through a lot of records and we've updated them as best we can, and that is the number we came up with. So we're doing some public education and not trying to frighten anybody, but just make them aware that what their service line is and some precautions they could take to address any concerns they have. Now, we don't have concerns ourselves about lead exposure, but we will be doing more testing here this summer. We're mandated to do it every 3 years, and we're going to be offering free lead testing to any of those residences that would like that. So we think that's a good thing to do for citizens, and we'll be doing that at their request.
So a service line is part of the infrastructure of a house itself. So it's not actually owned by the city of Ames. It's just the pipe leading from the water main to the house.
Yeah, that's correct. Actually, it's not really well understood exactly how that works. The city owns the water mains along the streets, of course, but the service line begins at the water main and it runs into the plumbing all the way into their house. That is actually owned by the property owner. So that is where the lead was used at one time. So those components, those are the places that most likely have lead in them, and those are owned by the individual property owners.
So basically these are probably the 303 oldest houses in Ames, or the ones who have had, you know, the least updating of their plumbing?
Yeah, they're not necessarily the oldest houses, but they are of a typically older houses of a specific time frame. We do know some time frames that you can be assured that you don't have a lead service line, and I believe in 1986 or 1987 is when it was outlawed using lead in installations like that. So if your home is newer than 1986, then you don't have to worry about lead service lines, but the areas are generally clustered into houses of about the same age. And those are actually going to be listed on our city website, that if anybody, whether you get a letter or not, is concerned and or at least curious as to where these are, they can check the map. It's an interactive map. You can even put in your address, and it'll identify to the best of our records what your situation is.
Well, there's been a lot of publicity about water quality around the country and even here in Story County. Is this education effort in response to some of that, you know, kind of growing awareness of people that, hey, my water might be contaminated?
Yeah, of course, a lot of this comes from the Flint, Michigan issue. That is, it's a sad deal that what has transpired there. And it has raised a lot of awareness about what we call water stability, you know, could be corrosive in the lead service lines. Typically, we have what we call slightly depositing water that actually forms a thin shell on the inside of pipes that literally form a protective barrier so the lead cannot get into the water. And Flint's water chemistry changed so suddenly that layer went away, and that's how they ended up with lead in their drinking water. So that whole issue has really brought about a lot of awareness. We are definitely not alone in answering a lot of questions. Every tour that we give anymore, I get asked about this, so, you know, I answer it. And it's gone. I think new regulations will come about because of this. It's a horrible deal, but I guess if there is any silver lining, I think some things will come about that, at least in the future, will be an improvement with those types of situations to make sure this does not happen again.
Yeah, the press often refers to the water that Flint, Michigan switched to as highly corrosive water. And I don't know whether that means acidic or oxidizing or whatever it is, but we don't have that situation here, correct?
That is correct. Like I said, water could either be corrosive or depositing, and it is important to maintain the right chemistry. You know, pH goes into that. You're right, you know, it could be acidic, but there's actually a lot of factors that go into whether water is corrosive or not. It's not just one thing. And our job as a utility is to make sure the combination of water properties in our water has the right chemistry to protect our citizens. And Flint's situation, that was not the case.
That's interesting. So corrosive versus depositing. Depositing can also be an issue. If you get too much depositing, then you have lime buildup and things like that.
Yeah, you have to walk the fine line because there's two ends of the spectrum. One is corrosive. We talked about that on the depositing side. You don't want to build up a whole bunch of lime buildup. Calcium deposits is what it is on the inside of pipes, because that would obviously reduce the carrying capacity of the pipes. It could clog up faucets and things like that. So you want to have a balance in there, and that's our job to make sure we have that.
So what exactly does go into the water stability equation, Lyle?
Yeah, some of the things we have the most control over are pH is the biggest one. Property called alkalinity in the water is another big one. Things like calcium hardness, total dissolved solids, even temperature. Temperature actually plays a big role in that. Things like sulfates and chlorides. Another one that you may not think of is actually detention time, which means how long the water sits there in piping, which was actually one of the issues in Flint because they had such a population decrease, dramatic population decrease, that they had this distribution system sized for a certain population, and then the population got much, much smaller. We still have the same piping system, but the water's sitting in there longer. So if the water is sitting somewhere longer, it tends to be a little bit more corrosive. So there are a lot of different things that go into this, and those are just a handful of them.
Wow. Lots to keep track of. And we've got lots of calcium. Is that right?
Yeah, we do. We have a relatively high hardness and with plenty of calcium to go around. Yeah, definitely.
Okay, and then you add calcium to get the calcium out.
It does seem a little counterintuitive, but yeah, we have lime in the process that we add some to take more out.
So basically, the water department is not a department that you want to cut completely from your city budget.
No, that probably wouldn't be advisable. I think electric would say the same thing. So no, I think we're a pretty important part of it. And probably, you know, when we have a water main break or water outage for whatever reason or power outage, it always becomes evident how important utilities, any utility, is for people in their everyday lives.
So let's talk a little bit about the changes that are taking place here in the water department. I know you're competing with the energy plant over there for press here, but you've got a pretty big development there on 13th Street, a big crane up there working away all the time. How soon is that new water plant going to be finished?
Yeah, this has been a really exciting project. It's been a long time coming. This actually started in 2008, so we are 8 years into this, and we still have a ways to go, but our new water plant is actually a year from May 17th. So next May 17th, it is anticipated to be what we call substantially complete, which means able to perform its function. Now, it's not going to be final completion is, I believe, August 2017, but we're about a year out from being able to actually move water out of that treatment plant. So everybody's really excited about that. We've all been taking part in this whole design process, and now we get to see the construction of it. It's neat to be able to be involved in the design of a facility that you could work the rest of your career in. We've all had played a part in that, and that's been really neat to see. So it's been a lot of work, but it's been a lot of fun too, and we're really glad to move in about a year from now.
Has that meant a lot of extra hours for you and your staff?
It has meant a lot of meetings, yes, and it's probably some extra hours. Quite frankly, next year, actually when we're starting it up, that's probably when the most time intensive, as far as like outside of normal business hours. I may have to bring a tent some nights, you know, when we get this thing rolling for the first time to make sure everything's going well. There will be some long hours about a year from now. But yeah, just endless meetings that we've had to go through. Again, a lot of people have played a role. So it's been a lot of work again, but a neat opportunity, especially I have an engineering background. So I have a particular interest in something like this. So for me to be here at this time, it's kind of a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for somebody to work in a utility like this.
We were talking about the water chemistry. Is the water chemistry going to change any when you have the new plant? Is that something that you got to be on the lookout for?
Yeah, we had kind of, when we started this project, some overriding goals, and two of them were we didn't want to change the taste of the water, and we didn't want to change the quality of the water. So we are going to keep the general process the same, and we're going to have a consistent chemistry. That's one thing we're going to definitely make sure of. We're a lime softening plant currently right now, and we're still going to be a lime softening plant with just a lot newer equipment, of course. It'll be more efficient. And during the design, we actually evaluated a number of different technologies, and it was decided for a number of reasons. Actually, it made the most financial perspective to stick with lime softening. It's what we know best, and we evaluated things like membrane technology. We weren't quite as comfortable with that, and it did actually end up being a little bit more expensive, so we didn't go that route. I would be more concerned about chemistry changes if we did go make a change, like go to membranes or something like that, but that's not going to be the case. We're staying with a very, very similar process, and we don't anticipate the chemistry changing.
So Ames Water is still going to have its trademark flavor that everybody loves.
We do fully expect that, you know, that we are known for having good tasting water. We take pride in that, and it does start with a good source. We're very fortunate to have a good well system to draw from, and now we're making sure the treatment part of it is taken care of for the foreseeable future and continue to produce the same quality product that we have for about 100 years running, actually over now, 100 years.
So the cause for this new water plant is basically increased demand, and we're heading into the season where people start turning on their water sprinklers. That's the biggest spike, right, in demand for water in Ames.
Yeah, definitely. Our demand is almost, if you tell me how much rain, if we're in the middle of the summer, and if you tell me how much rain we've had in the last 3 weeks, I can almost tell you what the water demand is, because it is completely driven by irrigation systems, really. You know, we have a base demand. Now, I can also tell you what the flow is with the students and without the students, because they're worth a certain amount, pretty consistent. Like just a couple weeks ago, we dropped demand significantly because of the students. But yeah, in the summer, people start irrigating, and I've actually already started to see that. And water demand does creep up. It's very, very, it's like clockwork. And if it rains one day, the demand will sharply drop. So that, you know, we try to promote smart irrigation practices because we want to keep that peak demand down, because that is what drives infrastructure. Now, you're right, the water demand was one of the reasons this project has come about, but also infrastructure assessment. Some of the places that needed to be repaired in this facility were the most difficult to get to and would have caused a lot of service interruptions. So in the analysis, just as much as demand is the infrastructure, the condition of that. So those two factors really drove this project.
Okay, well, exciting times here at the Ames Municipal Water Plant. Thank you so much, Lyle Hammes, superintendent of the Ames Water Plant.
Yeah, I'm glad to explain some of this to you. If you ever want to get an update, feel free to come on back.
You're listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio. I'm your host for today, Greta Anderson. Well, Lyle Hammes and his staff are certainly unsung heroes in our community. We turn now to some other local heroes, or as we like to call them here at KHOI, local treasures. Yesterday, a dozen talented students from Ames High School, together with at least as many talented middle schoolers, headed off to Menominee, Wisconsin, for the National Competition of the Science Olympiad. As part of our special pledge drive programming a couple weeks ago, station manager Ursula Rudenberg brought a number of these students, along with their coaches, into the studio here at the station to explore their journey. Let's listen to that interview now.
I have five young people here with me today. Welcome, members of the Science Olympiad team. Sitting with me at the table here from Ames High School is Nathan Chen, Nick Lang, Marina Lan, and Jason Chen, and Sarah Song from the Ames Middle School. Their coaches are here, Carrie Marsh and Peg Barber. Also, one of the coach parents is here, Sinian Jong Durbin. Welcome, everybody, and thank you for coming and being willing to tell your stories. Now, you just recently went to the state division of the Science Olympiads. Carrie, would you tell us what happened? When did this occur?
We went down to Coe College in Cedar Rapids, and it was April 9th. It was Saturday, April 9th, and they have all kinds of different events. And the events range from engineering skills to test-taking for biology and life sciences to chemistry events where they have to do all kinds of chemistry experiments and analyze data and all of things like that.
Now, as I understand correctly, that you usually have a team of maximum 15 students for 23 events, and that actually in the case of this team only had 12 members. And so you were a little bit of a handicap. Tell me what happened.
Our high school team only had 12 high schoolers. We were at a bit of a disadvantage. So we had a few middle schoolers that we moved up into some of the events so that we could complete all 24 events and have enough team members in order to make sure that the high school could be successful.
So these students were less experienced than the high school students. So one would think maybe that would make it harder. How did they do?
They practiced really hard. The entire team took first at state, which means we get to go to nationals in Menominee, Wisconsin. The entire middle school team also took first, and they get to go to nationals in Menominee, Wisconsin. We will be leaving for nationals on Thursday, May 19th, and returning in time for our graduating seniors to make graduation.
The nationals include science teams from the whole country?
Correct. There'll be a team from every state.
And as the coach, how optimistic are you that they'll win there, too?
This is my first year coaching Science Olympiad and my first year going to nationals with them. I'm excited for this team. These guys have just been putting in a ton of effort. I know that we have incredibly bright, intelligent, hardworking students and that they will do their absolute best. And that's all we really want. And we'd be proud of them for that.
Well, let's talk to some of the students and find out their stories. Hello, Nathan.
Hi.
Congratulations. Are you excited about going to the nationals?
I'm very excited. I'm a senior this year, and this is my last year in Science Olympiad. It'll be my fifth year going to nationals, so I'm excited to see how this trip will turn out. Nationals is a completely different experience every single year. Each year it's held in a different university in the nation, and each year brings about new teams from different states and also returning teams. So we get to meet up with old friends and meet new friends, also be able to interact with past event supervisors.
If this is your fifth year, presumably the Ames team has won before.
Correct, correct. This is the 23rd straight year for the Ames High School Science Olympiad team.
So in other words, they always win.
Yes.
Well, that says something about the coaching that's happening. Peg, explain a little bit more what really happens at the Olympiads.
This is nothing like a science fair project. There are different types of events. The events cover all of the disciplines of science. So we have some biology events, some chemistry, some physics, some earth science. And then we have engineering type events as well. So some of the events involve students actually studying and preparing to take a test. Entomology is one of those events where they have a list of, I can't tell you how many insects that they have to be able to recognize by maybe the class and genus, whatever, and then no information about them, like where they live, are they helpful, are they harmful, those types of things. And then they actually take a lab practical test. Other events are more lab-based. So they might, chemistry lab is one where there's a topic for each year and they actually have to do a lab. And then all of the calculations and analysis that's involved with the lab.
How much of this is known prior to the event itself?
They are given rules, and those are kind of the guidelines for that year. And then you kind of go from there and look at all kinds of different topics. There are guidelines from the national about each event, but you don't know until you get there for sure.
Also, you are the person who introduced the Science Olympiad. Is that correct?
That is correct.
To the state of Iowa?
Yes.
To the state of Iowa. Peg, why did you introduce the Olympiads to Iowa?
I got involved with Science Olympiad when I was teaching in Ohio about 28 years ago. And I did it in Ohio for 5 years, and I was so excited by what the students accomplished in Science Olympiad, because these events are not necessarily what they're learning in school. It pushes them beyond that. The middle school is more at a high school level, and the high school is more at a college level. And so the students are really pushed. And so I fell in love with Science Olympiad. And when I moved to Iowa, I said, oh, I want to have a Science Olympiad team. And they didn't have Science Olympiad in Iowa. So I started it.
How does one start something like this?
Well, I didn't know very many people, so I just contacted science teachers in neighboring school districts and said, hey, I've got this really neat program, and I'd like to get it started. And we had a few meetings, and that's how it started. I learned a lot, and I met a lot of people that way.
Thank you. Well, that's very, very interesting, what gets started. And it has really grown. It's been going on now for how many years?
23 years.
23 years. And from what I understand, the Ames team does pretty well, right?
We have done very well. The middle school has had a team for 23 years, and they've won state all but 3 of those years. And then when some of those middle school students went up to the high school, they wanted to continue, so they talked me into that. And they've been doing that for 22 years, and they've won state every year.
Nathan, tell us a little bit about what happened to you recently at the state division.
Well, at the state division, I participated in 4 different events. Those would be experimental design, dynamic planet, chemistry lab, and geologic mapping. And I took home 2 golds and 2 silver medals. One of the events that I really enjoyed this time was the experimental design event. Experimental design, I guess, is really just about giving the competitors a bunch of just household materials, maybe plastic bags, paper clips, pencils, anything, rubber bands. And we have 50 minutes to design and conduct an experiment and write about it. And this time we were given a topic to conduct an experiment about, where we had to determine an unknown liquid. We decided to use viscosity of a liquid to test how easily it would flow down an inclined plane.
You used viscosity to figure out what the liquid was?
We were given 5 different known liquids and looked at those liquids' viscosities and compared it to how fast maybe a few drops of the unknown liquid would move down a plane and just see which one was most similar.
So what was the unknown liquid?
It was actually plain old salt water. Yeah, so, I mean, maybe in Iowa it's not that common, but it wasn't something too mysterious. I would say our results were fairly conclusive, but it was kind of hard at times. But the 3 of us that were in the event worked out well as a team, I believe, and we were able to win the gold medal for that event.
You must be really putting yourself into this because you're winning. What do you get out of doing this?
Personally, I think you just learn something that can't be taught in the classroom, really. It's more of a hands-on activity or a trial-and-error process of learning. By being a part of Science Olympiad for the past 6 years, I've learned various things that I cannot learn in class.
And you like learning?
I would say so, yeah. I'm still in the learning mode.
When you do this, how do you feel?
I would say probably when we are working on our events, studying, building, all that stuff, sometimes it gets to be frustrating. There just always seems to be more information to absorb. There's almost no end. It's like a bottomless pit of information that you can just pull out of, and it's just impossible to learn everything. And so, yeah, it gets frustrating. But at competitions, if I do well on a test, I would think all the hard work paid off. Whenever something goes right, I would say for myself, I would feel a great sense of joy. It was well worth the time to study and learn all these different topics in science.
Jason, let's talk to you next. Do you know that relentless, bottomless pit feeling, too, that he was talking about?
Yes, uh-huh. Definitely. And then once you see the test with the questions, then thinking like, oh, I actually know this. And then it just feels good that you know the stuff on there. All of the preparing and studying and all that stuff is suddenly like all worth it.
It was intimidating at first, and then suddenly you realize you can do a lot, right?
Mm-hmm. My favorite part is probably competition.
What did you experience recently in the state division? What did you have to do?
I had three events. One of them was Scrambler, which was a building event. Another one was experimental design. My last one was Reach for the Stars, which was a test-taking event where you could say, countless hours studying, and then you would take a test, and whoever scored the highest on the test wins. I placed third in that event. And
what is Scrambler?
The point of that is to build a device, a launcher, and then also an ETV, which is the egg transport vehicle. So there's eggs, like referring back to the name Scrambler.
So it's a vehicle that transports one egg.
Yeah. You build a launcher and then a vehicle. And then the launcher, it's supposed to take the force from a falling mass and convert it into energy for the vehicle and to propel it a certain distance and come to a stop by itself. And they'll set out a wall called the terminal barrier. They'll give you a distance between 9 and 12 meters. You'd have to have data for 9 all the way up to 12. And then once you got there, they would tell you one of the distances. Then you'd have to calibrate your vehicle so that you could propel the vehicle as fast as possible and get as close to the center of the wall as possible without breaking the egg.
Did you succeed in doing that?
Yes, I placed first in that one.
How long did it take?
I believe it took around 3.2 seconds.
And the egg survived?
Yes, luckily.
Okay, Sarah, what did you do in the test?
I participated in experimental design. I was also an invasive species and Rhodes Scholar, which are both test-taking events. My partner and I, in both events, we had mentors. There was a lady from the DOT, and the person who helped us in invasive species was someone's mom on the team.
Explain what invasive species is.
So the U.S. has a list of invasive species. There's around 140 of them, I think. Mainly bugs and plants and vertebrates. And the test-taking part is you have to identify an invasive species and answer questions about it. It's also about common terms about invasive species. And we were required to make a binder on every single invasive species on the U.S. list. And so my partner and I took about 70 each, and we had to research each of those, and it took us a couple of months to do.
What was one particular invasive species that you found interesting?
There's an invasive species called rock snot, and it grows in water, and it looks like snot. It mainly grows in warm water.
I can see. This is a lot of work. Can you describe why you enjoy doing this?
A lot of my friends are in Science Olympiad, so doing Science Olympiad means that I can also see them and help them with their events, even though I'm not in their events a lot of the times. And going to competitions can be really fun. It's not just like the actual competition, but riding on a bus with all of your friends can be really fun, and staying in hotel rooms together, mm-hmm. and taking trips to other places.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Marina, how about you?
I just wanted to say what Sarah said. I also feel that it's good to have friends around, especially when we stay in the hotel room. We had a lot of fun.
When you're having fun in the hotel, do you talk about the tests?
We don't usually talk about the tests. We just like talk as friends and share stories. It's a really good time to be away from home just with friends.
Mm-hmm.
Then in the competitions, my partners and I are all get really concentrated on what we are doing, that we forget about all the other things. And our brains were functioning so fast that we didn't know what we were actually doing. And after the exams, we just feel, oh, wow, I'm so proud of myself. I just overcome such a hard test. And it's even more fulfilling when we win gold medals or things mm-hmm. to bring back home.
You get recognition.
Yeah, and help Ames High get the 23rd year to win.
Mm-hmm.
And we feel really proud to be a part of the team.
They sound like superheroes to me. When you go into the test, all of a sudden you put on your superhero costume. Marina Len, tell us what you did in the state finals.
I did 4 events in the state competition, and all of them are test-taking ones because I don't like building, and I like...
You don't like what?
I don't like building events. And the 4 events I did were disease detective, cell biology, protein modeling, and anatomy and physiology. So what I thought was most interesting for me was disease detectives, because we get to learn about all kinds of epidemiology things. And my partner's mom works at Iowa State. She's a professor of epidemiology, and she comes to teach us once a week. And I really felt grateful that she could take the time to do it for us. And I also learned a lot from her.
What did you find the most interesting about the diseases?
So I've learned how the epidemiologists work to find out what caused the diseases, then what kinds of measures we could take to prevent it. I think that these mm-hmm. things are really useful and interesting, which could save millions of lives. Like, we learned the story how people find out that Zika caused microcephaly in Brazil. And so in Brazil, some hospitals found out that a lot more babies were born with microcephaly, which is a kind of disease that a baby have a smaller head and later on develop a lot of diseases in their brains.
Mm-hmm.
And then the doctors did some surveys to the pregnant women, like asking them, did you drink alcohol? Did you smoke? What kinds of drugs did you use? And then they analyzed all the data and found out that the kind of mosquito have transmitted the Zika virus to the women, which caused the disease. And right now, the women are not recommended to get pregnant, and they have to wear long sleeves and use nets to prevent mosquito bites.
It's very interesting. Okay, thank you. We've got one more person here, and you're Nick.
Hello.
Nick, you are a middle school or a high school student?
I am a high school student.
Tell us what you did in the state division.
4 events. One is protein modeling with Marina. I have chem lab with Nathan here. And I also have Game On and Hydrogeology.
Explain what Game On is.
You have a computer at your event. And when you get there, the event supervisors give you a topic. And the idea is that you create a game that's implements some kind of scientific ideas related to this topic. At this competition, the topic was magnetism. So when we started, we had this idea to make a game where the user would be like a magnet, and then the user would control the magnet in order to pick up pieces of trash, like siphoning out trash from like waste disposal.
And then what do you have to do?
So you get 50 minutes to create a game using a program called Scratch, which is kind of a basic programming language, and it's really just like a rush to see how much you can get done to complete the game. It seems like a very long time, 50 minutes, but it's actually very short.
When you have to do a lot of problem solving.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how did you do?
We got 2nd.
What happened in your game?
The idea is that if the user wants to collect the bits of metal to score points. And if the user just failed to pick up enough of that trash, then he or she would lose.
Well, thank you. We have a parent here who also helped prepare, Sinian Jung Durbin. Sinian, talk a little bit about your role as a parent of one of the students and also as a mentor.
Thank you, Ursula. I'm a mother of a Ames Middle School Science Olympiad team member. For the parent mentors, the mentoring process is a forever memorable bonding time with their children, and I'm one of them.
And you're one of them.
It is truly a blessing. These youngsters' determination for learning, for overcoming difficulties, and managing their time have been inspiring, and their resilience to meet challenges and succeed have been humbling to me as an engineer. I vividly remember a sixth grader last year when the glider he spent many, many hours to build and many, many more weeks to practice flying crashed to the wall in the gym. He basically collapsed on the floor, nearly in tears. And a few moments later, he picked himself up from the floor, went to pick up the broken glider, opened his toolbox, and moved on fixing the glider. And he won the 16th place nationally. The program is a long marathon with the academic activities. I said it is a marathon as it lasts 8 months out of 9 months academic year.
So the training lasts 8 months.
Right. Mm-hmm. With regular 3 or 4 hours of practice weekly and numerous hours studying, designing, and building at home. The students are the most critical elements in the equation of the Science Olympiad. I see the program not just brings up a new generation of professionals in science, technology, engineering, mathematics, it does bring up stronger and better persons. As a parent, I greatly appreciate the three-teacher-coach team led by Mrs. Peg Babar, cornerstone of the Ames Science Olympiad program for 24 years and continuing. She and Mrs. Glenn and Mrs. Marsh dedicate their time and energy to coach and to supervise the teams. We have two teams, high school team and middle school team. Without their endeavor and sacrifices, the teams would not have reached where they are now.
Peg Barber, you're the head coach. Your comments?
I think it's the most outstanding science program there is available to middle school and high school students because they are actually doing science, and they're challenged, and they have fun. The events are fun, and I congratulate them on being super students. We've heard these five students. I work with them all the time, but just sitting back and listening to their comments, I once again am very impressed with their poise, their knowledge.
And what do you get out of experiencing all that?
I love watching the students grow. Mm-hmm. Marina just moved here this year from China, and I first met her at the high school in the fall when I was up there, and Mike Avis, the assistant principal, introduced us, and she was expressing some interest in Science Olympiad, and I said, come join us. And we've really enjoyed getting to know her, and I think it's been a way that she's gotten to meet students at the high school and get involved very quickly.
It's kind of a community, like-minded people.
And you get to work with mentors, too. So I work with a graduate student, Nathan Young, who works in the geology department at Iowa State. And it's really fun getting to learn stuff about hydrogeology with him.
Sarah mentioned as well that she had a mentor. Did all of you have mentors that helped you prepare?
I also had two mentors, actually, for my geologic mapping event. They were Chris and Aaron, who are professors at Iowa State University as well. They helped my partner and I just learn new material about essentially everything that has to do about maps and the Earth itself.
So you have folks at Iowa State and other places who are volunteering time to help prepare you?
Yep.
When you have a mentor like that, how often do you get together with them?
Every week, normally. And we thank them a lot for that because without them, I think we would not be able to get nearly as much information into our brain.
You enjoy meeting them or getting to know them?
Oh, yeah. They're really nice, really, really fun people to be around. Mm-hmm. They know how to teach a class, you could say, really, but still have the students be actively engaged and focused on the topic.
Carrie, you were one of the coaches.
Mm-hmm.
This is a winning team. The team has continued to win for 23 years. What do you think the secret is?
I think there's probably a combination of a few things. Number one, they are very hardworking. And number two, they are incredible collaborators. They want to help each other. They want to work well. And they do work well as a team. This is a team. When one does well, we all do well. In any one event, if we don't do well, the team suffers for it. So, and they know that, and they want to help each other, and they want to work together to get whatever it is that they need done or whatever obstacle they need to get over. And then you add the fact that they are incredibly resilient kids. If you hit an obstacle, they're persistent. What do we got to do to get over it? Who do we got to talk to? Who has the expertise to help us get where we need to go? Who has the resources?
There must be something that the adults are doing, too, because this is a tradition of winning. What are the adults doing to create winners?
I think Mrs. Glenn and Mrs. Barber especially are incredibly good coordinators. They're good at helping make sure that when the kids ask for something, we find a way to get them what they need. Or if they're looking for something or if they need a resource, their first thing to say, okay, let's coordinate with that. With maybe Iowa State has somebody, or maybe we could go to the DOT, or maybe we could go somewhere else and find some expertise or some book or something to help them out.
Ames High School and Middle School Science Olympiad team. I'm going to open this up for you guys. Any last words from you before we end?
Well, if I had one last thing to say, is I would have to encourage any young listeners out there, any Ames students in both middle school, high school, and elementary school to participate in the Ames Science Olympiad program. It's probably the most nourishing and fun program I've been in throughout all my years in the Ames School District, and I think it would be a very valuable and very valuable experience for future engineers and scientists to go through before they enter college and choose their career path.
It's good preparation.
Definitely is.
Any other comments?
Well, some of us already mentioned how amazing the coaches and the parents have been and all their support, but I guess I just want to say thanks again to all the coaches and parents. And I guess everyone on the team, both teams, for working hard and getting us to nationals.
And I want to say good luck.
Thank you very much.
Anything else?
So I just want to mention we're not just doing Science Olympiad, we're also doing science. And I highly encourage young people to get engaged in science and all the STEM things that could help our nation grow. And science is really interesting, even though it's hard. If you get through all the hardships, you will find that you're suddenly develop so much, and you will be grateful for getting involved in STEM.
Okay. Thank you so much for coming, and good luck to you. We do really see you as community treasures. So congratulations. You make a good example of what can happen in community, both to the adults and the children.
You've been listening to Local Talk on KHOI Community Radio, where we explore the people, stories, and events in Central Iowa. I've been your host, Greta Anderson. We started at the show with Alex Pfeiffer, narrating some of the history of carpool. To get the whole story, you can attend a talk by Kathy Sveck at the Ames Public Library this coming Tuesday, May 24th. I then spoke with Lyle Hammes, the superintendent of the Ames Water Plant, about the research they have done on which Ames residences may have lead-containing service lines, and about the new water plant, which will come online almost exactly a year from now. Finally, we aired station manager Ursula Rudenberg's interview with Nathan Chen, Nick Lang, Marina Len, Jason Chen, and Sarah Song, students who are, as you are hearing this broadcast, competing at the National Science Olympiad Contest in Wisconsin, along with their coaches Carrie Marsh and Peg Barber, who established the competition in Iowa, and Sinian Zhang Durbin, a parent and mentor. Local Talk will be rebroadcast at noon and 7 p.m. You can listen to today's Local Talk show and any of our past Local Talk shows online at our website, khoifm.org. That's khoifm.org. There you will also find information about our guests along with relevant links to today's stories. Thanks to our webmaster, Ron Carson, for posting that info. Local Talk was engineered by Paul Megahertz. Our theme song is Backtrackin' by Al Harris and Tom Richards from their CD, The Ballad of Kate Shelley. KHOI welcomes volunteers of all ages, skills, and descriptions. All you need is a passion for community. If you're inspired by what you hear, call us at 292-2878. That's 292-2878, or contact us through our website, khoifm.org. If you enjoyed the show, tell your friends. Remember, your participation as listener and your generous contributions are what make KHOI possible. Special thanks to those who contributed during our recent pledge drive, and it's not too late to give. Thanks for listening, and see you again on the radio.